Sunday afternoon. And this afternoon I have Dean Jacob with the Marion Community Foundation in the studio with me. Hey, Dean, it's good to see you.
Great to see you too, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
I know you've been on this station in the past, and the Marion Community Foundation does a lot in our community, and that's what we're here to talk about today. So where would you like to begin?
Well, maybe the beginning. How about that? For those who aren't real familiar with the Community Foundation, why don't I give a little bit of a history on it? Community Foundation began 21 years ago, and it was started as a result of the sale of the assets of MedCenter Hospital. Okay. So for those of us who have been around for a while, remember that we used to have two hospitals in Marion, and one of them was MedCenter Hospital. Started by the Dr. Frederick Smith, Frederick C. Smith, and then carried on by his two sons, Frederick Smith and Philip Smith. And that was a nonprofit charitable hospital and was created by them as a foundation. And the foundation basically owned and operated the hospital. So at a point in time when there was really not any more need for two hospitals, you know, much more outpatient work being done and so forth, the MedCenter made the decision to sell its assets to Marion General. So they did that, and they had a good chunk of money in their hands. They had about $11 or $12 million or so. And a couple of years before that, George Alber had died. And many people know the name George Alber and know that he was a very wonderful philanthropist, left quite a legacy to Marion, tens of millions of dollars, in fact. But there was no Marion Community Foundation at that time for him to leave his money to. So instead, he left a large chunk of that money for the benefit of Marion, but to the Columbus Foundation. Oh. And so at the time that the MedCenter Hospital was, you know, winding up its operations, the people who were on that board had a lot of foresight and said, you know what, we're required by law to take this money that we have from the sale of the assets, and we have to give it to another charity. Well, why not give it to ourselves and recreate ourselves, reinvent ourselves? And that's what they did. So they went to the IRS and the Attorney General. They got permission to change their mission to become a community foundation. Okay. So the Community Foundation then started, again, 21 years ago as a result of the sale of those assets. And so the very first fund was called the Healthcare Fund. And so the money that was from those assets was used and is still used today to provide grants to the community for healthcare needs. And it's still here today, 21 years later. It didn't all just get spent out, because that's what a community foundation does. They primarily create endowment funds. All right. So lots of people think of endowment funds in terms of universities, but they're all types of endowment funds. And community foundations are one of them. And so what a community foundation does is take the assets that are donated to them by charitable people, and we invest them for the long term. And then we have a spending policy that says, how can we spend as much as possible from these funds each year, but make them last forever? And so that's what we do. So every year now, there is a gift out of this healthcare fund that can provide grants for healthcare needs in our community. Since that time, we've been able to receive many, many more gifts from many more charitable people and organizations. So originally starting out with a very nice start of around $11 million from the hospital proceeds, but now we are just now over $50 million. And so you can imagine how that has multiplied what we're able to do in the community. So now we have over 300 funds. So going from that first fund, the healthcare fund, to over 300 of them now. Scholarships, grant funds, all sorts of different types of ways that we can benefit the community.
And I'm looking at, what am I looking at here? The annual report for 2018. Some of those categories are, of course, health and wellness, like you were talking about, arts, history and culture, education, faith-based, quite a few different areas that are served by your foundation?
Just think about anything you can think of in terms of a charity, and we can fund it. So that's the beauty of a community foundation. We're place-based. We're not sort of idea-based, so to speak. We can cover all those different areas, you know, seniors, students, health, arts, entertainment, animal welfare, you know, again, think of whatever you can in terms of what would be a charitable cause, and we can help fund it. And then we are primarily a community foundation. I mean, we are a community foundation, so we're primarily concerned with our community. Sure. So whereas Columbus has its community foundation, they take care of the Columbus area. And there's a Union County foundation. They'll take care of Union County. There's a Cleveland foundation. In fact, there's about 1,000 community foundations in the country right now. And they're mostly place-based, as opposed to private foundations, which might pick a particular cause. So, you know, there might be a foundation that supports Shriners Hospital. So they're going to support Shriners Hospitals all over the country, whereas we're going to support healthcare needs in our community.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about are these, when you help an organization, is that considered a grant? Okay.
Correct.
You would have to go through the grant process.
Yes and no.
Okay.
So we have a variety of different types of grants and grant funds. And what we like to say is it depends on our donor. We're very donor-centric, okay? So if you were to come to us as a donor and say, I want to create a fund, an endowment fund that's going to permanently benefit my community, mm-hmm. then we're going to sit down, we're going to have a conversation. I'm going to say, well, you know, what interests you? What are your interests in the community as far as being charitable are concerned? And so some people will say, well, you know what? Gee, I really like these ideas of scholarships. I want to create a scholarship fund. I like helping kids further their education. So we can start a scholarship fund. But let's talk on the grant side. On the grant side, there's lots of different options there, too. So again, let's say the person comes in, we're having a conversation, and they start talking. We can tell right off the bat they've got a favorite. There's an organization in town that just is really their favorite organization. And so pick whatever that might be. Palace Theater, Boys and Girls Club, YMCA, Marco, Wings of an Angel, anything you can think of in terms of, a charitable nature. Churches, for example, schools fall in this category. Any of those types of organizations, Habitat for Humanity, mentoring, whatever that may be, okay? So they say, all right, let's pick one. My favorite is the Palace Theater.
Okay.
I want to create a perpetual fund that will benefit the Palace Theater forever. So we would set up that fund, and that's called a designated fund. And every year, that fund will produce some money designated specifically for the Palace Theater. And so on our end of it, it's relatively easy. We're just going to, every year on the same date, we're going to cut a check to the Palace Theater, and it's going to benefit them. Whatever fund, whatever charitable organization they've designated. Another fund type is called a donor advised fund, and these are very popular now. We've got a couple of different different ways to create those, but still in general it's roughly the same idea, only this time and the IRS gets involved in a lot of what we do because we're a charity, and so we're giving people tax deductions and so forth. So they give us lots of rules. And with a donor advised, well, with any charitable gift to us, the basic rule is this. If you're going to claim a charitable tax deduction, the donor has to make it a completed gift, I should say. So that means they kind of have to cut their strings, all right? And one of those strings is being able to tell us what to do with this fund after it's been created. So legally, through the eyes of the IRS, once somebody creates a fund and we'll set it up however you want it. You want to make it payable to the Palace Theater, that's great. Okay, we'll set up. All right, you want to make a scholarship fund and say it goes only for students who go to Harding High School and they have to have a 3.0 GPA and they had to have played on a baseball team? That's what we'll do for you. We'll create it however you want to. But once it's set up, That's kind of it. You can't come back later and say, well, I've changed my mind. I want to do something different with it. Okay? Donor advised fund is just a tad different, however. Donor advised fund, the IRS says you can create a donor advised fund and give the donors the ability to make a recommendation each year. Okay. So now you've got a donor that comes in and says, you know, I like to support a variety of different things in my community. I don't necessarily have a favorite. So each year we'll tell them, here's the amount that your fund is available to spend. Where do you want us to spend it this year? Okay, this year I want it to go to the Boys and Girls Club. Come in the following year. Now, next year I want it to go to Habitat for Humanity. You know, wherever they want it to go, we can change it each year. And then we have two other types of funds, and they're called Field of Interest and Unrestricted. So somebody comes in and says, you know what, I don't have a particular favorite, but I really like the arts. Okay, I want to support the arts in Marion, Ohio. So we'll create that as a field of interest. And I'll talk about the other one in the same breath, the unrestricted fund, where they come in and say, you know what, this fund's going to last forever. I can't begin to predict what things are going to be like a year from now, 5 years from now, 20 years from now. You, the Marion Community Foundation, are going to be around forever. And so you decide. So those last two that I talked about, the field of interest and the unrestricted funds, we have a grants committee. So I'm getting back to your original question now. So in this case, yes, somebody needs to apply. So organizations in the community that are 501c3 charitable organizations or equivalents like schools and churches and governmental entities, they would put an application and they'll say, here's our need. Here's what we'd like to do with some money. And they give us, you know, all the things that we ask for them. And then our grants committee gets together and evaluates all of those different requests and then makes distributions to those that we feel are serving the needs of the community, have a valid need, or doing a good job of it. And then we award grants to those. So designated grants go out on a regular basis to whomever the donor wants us to. And donor advised funds, we get advice from them, suggestions, and then the others are competitive and are based upon a grant application.
Okay. Now, your grants aren't matching grants. I mean, the organization doesn't have to raise a certain amount, then you match that. It's just straight that amount.
Sometimes.
Okay.
Sometimes. And we view matching grants as a benefit to an organization. So let's say an organization comes to us and they say, we need to raise $30,000 for a program. We've got, pick one. Look here. I'm trying to think where one that we've done this with just recently. But let's say Marion Mentors. Okay, so Marion Mentors is a program that we support. And let's say they come to us and they say they need $30,000. Again, we've got a competitive process here. We'll get any on any given year requests that go from $1 million or $2 million, and then our competitive grants money available is usually around $500,000. So we can't give money to everybody. So we're going to go back to the organization. We might say to Marion Mentors, we'll say, all right, you need to raise some of this money yourself. We'll help you. And a way we'll help you is for every new dollar that you raise, we'll give you a dollar.
Okay.
Up to a certain amount. And we see that as a benefit to that organization because they can then go out and say, your gift of a dollar is really a $2 gift to us because Community Foundation will give that to us. So we'll do that on occasion. But typically, no. Typically, it's either the full amount that they request or some sort of a partial amount with not really any strings attached.
I see this this list is almost endless of the organizations that you have helped. It's pretty amazing.
It's kind of hard to really think of an organization in town that we haven't helped at least at one point in time over the last 21 years. And, you know, that's... There are so many great organizations in this community who are really doing good, and it's a struggle for our grants committee to sit down and analyze these requests and really try to discern where's the best place in any particular year to give that money. And it's very tough. And, you know, it's great when I sign a grant check and we deliver a grant check to an organization and they're happy and they're all smiles and they're going to do great work. Mm-hmm. On the other side of that coin, we have to make that tough call and contact somebody and say, I'm sorry, you didn't get a grant this year. And that can be for a variety of reasons. And we try when that happens, especially if we always welcome a call. We'll try and tell you, what was the reason that we didn't make a grant that year? And we try to help them or try and be very honest with them and say, you know what, it just doesn't quite fit with the direction that we're trying to go this year.
And maybe within that next year they can change and maybe meet your direction, your criteria, better than what they did this year.
Absolutely. And we try to help people. I always say that we're trying to help you succeed. We're not trying to make it difficult for you. So we'll give you hints and suggestions. Again, it's always going to be competitive, and we'll get some organizations that receive grants maybe several years in a row, and then the next year they don't, and vice versa. Other organizations that don't receive grants from us, and then they do. So, again, a lot of it has to do just with sometimes timing is everything. Sometimes it's the way they've improved a grant request. Maybe they've tweaked their program, they've changed their program, they've got a new program, or something like that that we can help them.
It looks like you have several financial advisors that you work with, such as Wells Fargo, Merrill Lynch, Stifel,
yes. Stifel. Yeah, it's kind of a journey entry.
And Redstone Financial Services, as well as Lehman Capital Management Group.
Right.
So,
people don't always necessarily understand endowments and how they work and the financial side of it. So again, an endowment is a permanent gift. And if you want to think of it in its most basic terms, now it's a little bit different, a little bit more complex than this, but in its most basic terms, people give us a gift and we call that principal. And then that principal is going to earn something. It's going to earn some dividends or interest or some capital gains based upon how it's invested. And then we're going to preserve that principal and spend the earnings or the growth from it. Like I say, it gets a little bit more complicated than that. But what we do then is we take all these donations that we're given now up to $50 million, and we invest those in a very diverse portfolio of investments, and we use our local advisors. Again, we're a community foundation. We want to do things locally, and so we do have a firm, though. We do have a firm that specializes in giving advice to community foundations such as ours. It's called Clearstead. They're Clearstead Advisors. They're based in Cleveland. And they have some people assigned to us, and they will help us. They're the experts in the field. So they'll go out and help us devise an investment portfolio that's based on institutional investing as opposed to individual investing. I mean, you and I, if we're wanting to do some investing, we got a time horizon, right? You and I, we're going to plan on when we want to buy a house or when our kids are going to college or when we're going to retire. Institutions have infinite timelines, but they have annual needs.
Right.
So there's a balance there. So Clearstead comes in, helps us devise the way that we're going to invest. We create an investment policy, again, so that principal is always going to be there, okay? Yet we can still spend each year. And so then our local advisors need to follow that investment policy, but they're the ones actually making the investment decisions. So, for example, our investment policy might say we're going to invest no more than 40% in U.S. equities this year, okay? And we'll give them a range. We'll say like between, say, 30 and 40% you can go in U.S. equities. Mm-hmm. One particular advisor might feel very bullish. The stock market's just going great. U.S. equities are doing really well. I'm going to invest the portfolio that I have for the foundation 40%. I'm going to go the max that I can in U.S. equities. You might get another one who says, yeah, you know what? I think the recession's coming. It's closer than what other people think. I'm going to pull back a little bit from U.S. equities. I want to put some more things into, maybe they feel like, of course, they're not right now, but they might feel like things are going better in global markets. So they might put more in global markets, or they might say, oh, we need more in income-producing assets like bonds. And so they'll go maybe 30% then in U.S. equities and something else. So they have these choices, and we rely on our local investors to make those smart decisions for us. And we have conversations and consultations with them all the time throughout the year, and we meet quarterly. Our investment committee meets quarterly with our people from Clearstead, and we make sure everybody's always on the same page.
If somebody is feeling that they want to start a fund or somehow contribute, what's the process? Who do they come see? What do they do?
Mm-hmm. It's very easy. One thing they can do is sometimes people just want to contribute to known funds that are already been created, and they know that they're here and they want to just continue to add to them. So they maybe just want to give $100 to something that they know. So, for example, we have a fund. It's called the Stephen Chaney Memorial Fund. Stephen Chaney, I think a lot of people are familiar with him. He was a Vietnam veteran who was killed in action performing a heroic duty 50 years ago. And his friends and family created a fund in his honor at the Community Foundation, and it goes to benefit students seeking a Catholic education here in the community.
Okay.
So let's say somebody has an interest in that. They can simply go to our website. Well, they could just write a check, or they could go to the website, look up the fund, and make a contribution by credit card on the website. They go down through there, and they say, oh, there's the Stephen Chaney Fund. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm looking for. And they could contribute $100, and it gets added to that fund. So that's one way to do that. And they can pick any one of our over 300 different funds that we have. Again, we have funds for scholarships. We have funds for the Tallgrass Trail. We have funds that support the Palace Theater, the Boys and Girls Club, you name it. Or somebody says, I'm ready to create my own. I want to start my own legacy that's going to be permanent here in Marion. They want to create an endowment that's going to last forever. So then it's a simple matter. Pick up the phone, give us a call. They're going to get put through to me, and I'm going to say, let's have a conversation. Let's find out what it is that you're interested in. And so they'll come up to see us. We're located at 504 South State Street. We're on the first floor of the Stengeltrue Museum, right there at the intersection of Washington and Delaware Avenue, and at Five Points area. And come in, and let's just have a conversation. Let's talk. What are your interests? What is it that you want to do? And then based upon that, we'll design one of those funds that I was talking about. Is it a scholarship fund? Is it designated? Is it donor advised, field of interest, or unrestricted? From there, it's a matter of drawing up the criteria. If it's a scholarship fund, we're going to figure those things out. Do you want it to be available for all students in Marion County? Do you want it to be for students just going to Ohio State University or some other school? Do they have to have participated in band or whatever it's going to be? We'll create that fund agreement. If it's a grant fund, same sort of thing. Is it you want it to be specifically for one organization, or we want to make it more open-ended? Once we have that idea in mind, we'll create a very simple, it's usually just a two-page document. It's a fund agreement. It just says, you know, what we, the foundation, are going to do and what you want us to do. And then it's a matter of figuring out how do we fund it. Okay, we got to get some money in there to make this happen. So an endowment fund, again, is going to spend only a percentage of what's been given.
Okay.
So, and right now our spending rate is 4%. So, again, go back to what I mentioned earlier. We're investing so that this money stays there forever and lasts forever, but we want to maximize our spending. And as everybody knows right now, interest rates are not certainly what they used to be. So interest rates are tough. So we're trying to make that balance where we can spend enough but not deplete, or not even deplete, but not even begin to affect the principal balance of that fund. So at 4%, so if somebody comes in and says, here's $10,000, then at a 4% rate, we're basically going to spend $400 out of that fund each year. Now, somebody might say, I just gave you $10,000 and you're only spending $400 of it. And yeah, you're exactly right. People who create endowments are people who are thinking about the long term.
Right.
So, and I'm not disparaging one bit whatsoever. Somebody that comes in and says to an organization, here's $10,000, spend it however you want to. Mm-hmm. You give $10,000 to your church, they need that $10,000. They're gonna patch the roof. They're gonna fix the potholes in the parking lot. They're gonna fix the boiler. They're going to send some kids on a mission trip or whatever that may be. They're easily going to find a way to spend that $10,000. And people that want to give that way, well, God bless them. You know, that's great. Other people say, I want to take a little bit of a long-term approach to this. I want something to be given every year, over and over and over and over again. So if we start doing some simple math, all right, if at $400 a year on a $10,000 investment, $400 in the first year, $400 in the second year, and so on. Mm-hmm. After 25 years, that $10,000 has been returned now to the community or to that organization. But in the 26th year, there's another $400. And in the 27th year, there's another $400, and so on and so on and so on. The Community Foundation is going to be here forever. There's never been a Community Foundation that fails. They don't fail. The only reason they're going to ever fail is if we have a catastrophic depression in this country that just... So the very first foundation was the Cleveland Foundation, started in 1914, and it's still around and bigger than ever. So the Marion Community Foundation is going to be around and will grow bigger and bigger every year. So by multiplying those gifts year after year after year after year, you're guaranteeing to that organization that there's going to, or to the community, that there's going to be that influx of money over and over and over again. And then the really neat thing about that is people can create a legacy for themselves, mm-hmm. because they can create these funds in their own name. So they can make it the George Smith Fund. And then every year, we're going to write a check in the name of George Smith to whatever organization is the recipient of the grant or the scholarship, and it will go on and on and on even after the person is deceased. And so it's a permanent legacy to this community, to their family, to their friends, that George Smith cared about their community.
Okay, one particular organization, I guess you could say, that has benefited from the foundation is the new Center Street Market that's the old tobacco store that's being revamped. I think that's really exciting. You want to tell about how that came about?
Sure. So that's a that market is being created by the Center Street Community Health Center. It's going to be an outreach from them. And of course, you know, a health center is concerned with helping people's health. That's right, exactly. And of course, what they do now, of course, at their health center primarily, obviously, is taking care of their immediate health needs. You know, you've got a cold, you go in there and you get some medicine for it. You need your cavity filled, you go to their dentistry part. You need some eyeglasses, you go to their optometry. You need some behavioral health assistance, you go and get that assistance. But health also is proactive, and how do we keep people healthy so that they don't have to go in and you know, require assistance after they've become sick?
Sure.
And so part of that is eating healthy and having access to healthy foods. And so, you know, they talk about what are called health or food deserts. So a food desert is a place where, you know, there's an area, some sort of geographical area, where people can't easily get to food. Can't easily get to a market. Those of us that have a car, a reliable car, a reliable form of transportation, and we can get wherever we want to, or we happen to live next door to a supermarket or something like that, we take that for granted. Mm-hmm. But there are lots of people that live in an area where that's not the case for them. They don't have reliable transportation, and there's no grocery store or supermarket that's near them. So they have to walk either great distances or do without. And so Center Street Health Center decided that they would try and tackle this problem downtown, which is a food desert. There's no grocery store or anything downtown. We have some pharmacies and drug stores that sell a little bit of food, but you're certainly not going to get any fresh vegetables there. You're not going to get certain healthy foods and things like that. So the health center, Center Street Community Health Center, through funds given as a grant from the Marion Community Foundation, purchased the old cigar stand there on the corner, which had been sitting there empty and was becoming an eyesore and also a danger. So our grants committee saw this as a win-win in two regards. One, we can help create a market that's going to provide healthy food options for people in a food desert. And it's going to also help with community development. It's going to help spur on activity in the downtown area that will create more foot traffic, which in turn creates more community development, more economic development. And, of course, the better economic development and community development you have, the better off your citizens are. So we're excited to see that project moving forward. They're also going to include classes on how to prepare healthy food and give information to people on, you know, making healthy choices and things like that.
Sounds great. Another place that you've helped quite a bit from what I can see here are parks and the environment, such as Terradice and...
Right. So, of course, one of the big... Terradice was Trella Romine's project. And she, of course, wanted to preserve the prairies that were in this community and keep that as a history, something that our local historian, local people interested in history can maintain forever. And so we have some funds dedicated for that purpose, and her son is still involved in that, and so we're able to support that. In addition, one of our big projects over the last several years had been and still is really the Tallgrass Trail.
Oh, yes.
And so we were one of the main supporters for that Tallgrass Trail right from the beginning. And, of course, right from when it started out, when it was just a quarter of a mile long. And now, of course, it's 13 miles long. And, of course, thanks to Dan Sheridan and all the people who really took that on as a cause and continued to push it and push it and advance it. And we're just happy that we were able to provide some of the funding to give to those people who really care about it.
Yes. Things such as food shelters and food shelter and support. Habitat for Humanity, St. Vincent de Paul, Leap and Outreach. You work in those areas as well.
So, like as I mentioned earlier, too, you know, one of the nice things about a community foundation, we're not restricted to certain things. And so, whereas we try very hard to fund programs and organizations and causes that will move the community forward, we're also there to be able to support programs and organizations that are helping people as a safety net. I mean, you know, unfortunately, we have people in the community who just are without, and they are in need, often and usually through no fault of their own. They've lost a job or whatever. They've fallen with an illness or whatever that is. They've got some chronic problems, and so we can help support them through some great places like Leap and Outreach and St. Vincent de Paul and other organizations that are out there, food pantries that are trying to help these people with their needs.
Well, let's talk some about your scholarships. I have in front of me a folder that has a lot of pictures of young folks that have received scholarships from the Marion Community Foundation. What would you like to say about that?
Well, you say lots of pictures. There should be about 189 of them, by my count. 189 different students received scholarships from Marion Community Foundation this past year. This was the first year we were gave more than $400,000 in scholarships. So we were excited about that. And, of course, and education is just the foundation to almost everything, right?
Right.
And so we're, the Community Foundation believes in giving to these students who want to further their education and better their education. I believe our second fund that was created after that healthcare fund was actually a scholarship fund. So we've been in the scholarship business, so to speak, for almost our full 21-year existence, and it's grown again from that one fund to now over 100 scholarship funds. Wow. It's also a competitive process, and it's an interesting selection process, too, because, again, it's donor-centric. So a donor comes into us and says, I want to create a scholarship fund, and it's going to go to students who go to Harding High School and play baseball, okay? So let's say you've got a student now who applies, and they are a 4.0 student. They got a perfect score on the SAT. They're going to Harvard or Stanford or Columbia or whatever, and they went to River Valley High School. And they apply for a scholarship. They are not going to receive a scholarship award from that one scholarship fund because they don't meet the donor's criteria.
Right.
They didn't go to Harding and they didn't play baseball. So now we do have funds that support students who excel academically and can go to any different school in Marion County. And also outside the county, too, we have some like that. But it's based on that criteria. So whereas some scholarships are academic and merit-based, most others are criteria-based. What is it that the donor favored? You know, and so these things are personal to the donor. So if a donor had a health scare or something like that, and so they want to help students who are going to be going into the healthcare profession, they've been touched by, you know, some sort of need in the healthcare, they're going to make their scholarship for students who are going into the healthcare field. And they may want it to go to certain institutions, for example. They have to go to a certain school. So it might be in pharmacy, for example, at Ohio Northern. That's where the student has to go. Mm-hmm. So there are those criteria, and then they have to meet that criteria. Now, the good thing for the students who are applying, and not too early to start thinking about this now as the weather's starting to change. Our scholarship application goes online live on January 1st each year. And the nice thing about this is it's all done online and it's one single application. So even though we have over 100 different scholarship funds and we'll give out a bunch of different scholarships this year, in fact, this last year we did 263 different scholarship awards. They only have to fill out one application.
Okay.
Now, the application will ask for a lot of information about the student, and then it'll ask a lot of questions. So it'll ask questions such as, you know, what school do you go to? What's your intended major? What activities did you participate in high school? And so then the computer program, you know, that's the application process, kind of filters all these answers down and tells us which scholarships these students qualify for. Did the student go, in my earlier example, did they go to Harding and did they play baseball? If yes, then they qualify for this particular scholarship. Did they have a GPA? We have some scholarship funds where the students have to be in the top 50% of their class, but not in the top 10%. Now, we've got about four of those. So these are donors who come to us and say, you know what, education's really important, but you know what, I wasn't one of those top students. But after I got in college, I really applied myself and I was able to succeed. And, you know, I didn't have that 4.0. I wasn't at the top of my class. So if a student answers that question and says, yes, I'm in the top 50%, but not in the top 10%, again, it whittles them down and filters them down into, and they qualify for certain scholarships. Then from there, we have the scholarship committee will review and assess all the different applications, look at them, kind of similar to the grants. We'll get twice as many applicants as we have money to give out. So unfortunately, not everybody will get a scholarship, but it's also the same thing like we talked about in our grants. We have some students that will receive a scholarship award in one year, not the next year, and vice versa. Their first application, they didn't receive a scholarship from us, but they applied again the following year, and they did. And that's something else worth mentioning, is that some of these scholarships are only for high school students. But most of our scholarship funds now apply for students who are also already graduated. They're already into college. We found that money is a little bit easier to find for students coming right out of high school. And then once they get into college, how do they support their second, third, and fourth years, for example? Right. And so a lot of our scholarships now allow people to apply again. And so, like I said, some students might not get a scholarship their first year, but their second year or their third year, they apply again. And, hey, that year they wrote a better essay. They filled out a better application. They've grown a little bit. They've switched their major. Any number of things could happen that helps them to qualify now for a scholarship.
Okay, and according to what I have in front of me, there are 122 scholarship funds available. That's amazing.
I would have to say we're a very robust scholarship program. There, if you look at other community foundations our size, you're not typically going to find one that has as many scholarship funds as we do. It's just something I think that that caught hold here and has been very effective, and we're very proud of it. And so we've been able to give out lots of scholarship money, but again, it's I wish we could give it to everybody, you know, but it's tough.
Yes, it is. One thing we haven't talked about is, you told what your location is, but is there a story behind how you ended up at the Stingletrew Museum for your headquarters?
Well, this predates me, so I've been there for 6 years, and I believe they've been at the Stingletrew Museum now since about 2008. I think that was just a matter of the Stingletrew Museum is in what was the Ozias Bowen Mansion. So that's the big two-story house up there at the top of the hill, again at the intersection of Washington and Delaware Avenue. And so that house was purchased in the 60s by Henry True. Okay. Henry True was the grandson of Ozias Bowen's second wife. Okay, Ozias Bowen was a local attorney, also became an Ohio Supreme Court justice. His first house is one of the houses occupied by Lipley's printing and graphics.
Sure.
Yeah,
East Center.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, right. So if you look at that where they're located, one of those houses is a brick house.
Right.
Built, I think, around 1840s, and that was his first house. In 1864, which always amazes me, right during the middle of the Civil War, mm-hmm. he decides to move out to the country.
Okay.
And the country at that time, of course, was at the top of what's known as Barry's Hill, and so it's up there in that hill. So he builds this beautiful two-story brick mansion up there. So again, fast forward many years, the house, of course, falls out of the family. It's used for many different purposes, including some businesses and so forth. Henry True decides, I'm going to go in and buy this house and preserve it. So he buys the house. He had a good friend, Frederick Stingle. Frederick Stingle was a collector. He collected all sorts of things, from glassware to early American artifacts to primitive pioneer tools and so forth, dishes, all sorts, clocks, many, many, many things. So the two of them decided in their wills they were going to combine their efforts. And so by their wills, they created the Stingletrew Museum. And Henry True said, I got a big old empty house up there. And now this is different than Henry True's house, which is at the corner of State and Church Street, right across from the Marion County Historical Society.
Okay.
That's his house.
Okay.
That's also a museum, and that's preserved basically the way he left it. It's fully furnished and everything. Our place, the Stingletrew Museum, is a combination of what was an empty house and all of Frederick Stingle's collections. So that was a museum, and really a house museum like that is hard to sustain itself.
Mm-hmm.
So the foundation, being a charity, they said, look, we need a little bit of space. And so they got a couple of rooms on the first floor of the mansion. And it was a nice relationship. Somebody was there all the time in case there was a leak or something needed fixed, keep the heat on and all that kind of stuff. Over time, the community foundation has grown significantly. So we now take over basically the first floor, but we've kept everything there. All of Frederick Stengel's stuff is there. We've done a lot of work to the house. We put a lot of money into the exterior of the house last year to preserve that house and be able to have it open. So when people come and visit the foundation, we say, come on and take a look at the house. Take a look at all these things that Frederick Stengel has. So it's a nice relationship.
I need to do that someday, too. I haven't been through the house yet, so.
Yeah, great.
That would be.
Yeah, lots of interesting things in there.
We have about three more minutes. What else would you like to share?
What I really wish I could share, and we really didn't talk too much about it, are all the stories behind our various funds. I did mention, you know, Stephen Chaney's fund, but we have, you know, with every one of our 300 funds, it's created by a different donor. And those donors have different stories behind them. Sometimes they're tragic stories. Sometimes these funds are created in memory of people who have died too early, like Stephen Chaney or mm-hmm. Mandy Kruger or Kruder or Andrew Wigton or any number of people, you know, young people who have died. And people use these funds as a way of preserving that legacy and keeping their legacy and their memory alive. There are other people who create funds while they're living because they want to do something good for the community. And I wish I could tell you every one of those 330 stories, and I wish we had time to do that. But those are really important. We keep photographs of those people in our building, and whenever we get guests there, that's one of the main things we like to show them. Here are these pictures, and we'll take the opportunity then to talk about some of these stories. So we always invite people to come and create their own story, their own legacy. It's easy to do. You don't have to be a millionaire, and we're going to be around forever to do good in Marion, Ohio.
Well, maybe sometime in the future you can come back and just share some of those stories with us. I think that would be a good show.
That would be great, because there really are just some wonderful, wonderful stories. Amazing people out there, you know, that care about their community, and again, preserving legacies and honoring memories of people. You know, one we just started up just this week, this last week, was the Vohl Family Bowling Green State University Fund. Many people know Fran Vohl. His wife, Marty, just succumbed to a battle with cancer. And so Fran and his family are starting up a scholarship fund in Marty's honor, but also in honor of their entire family, who has a very strong connection to Bowling Green State University.
Okay. Well, Dean Jacob, thank you for being with us. And be tuned in again next Monday at 5:15 to The Mike Wilson Show on WWGH.
Thanks, Mike.
You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 LP, Marion, Ohio.